This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yeheyes Wuhib in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight...
It causes about 11 million avoidable deaths each year. Still, today, 670,000 neonatal deaths occur due to sepsis.
Rick Johnston of the World Health Organization on how the lack of basic hygiene services affect many healthcare facilities. Details coming up. Also, renewed fighting between Ethiopian government and Tigray forces has shattered a five-month-old truce. We'll have these stories and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. Mikhail Gorbachev, who presided over the demise of the Soviet Union and helped end decades of Cold War fear, has died at age 91. His role in the end of the Cold War between the Communist Soviet Union and the capitalist Western nations earned him a Nobel Peace Prize and the lasting enmity of millions of Russians, bitter about the chaos unleashed by the collapse of the world's largest country. Abe Donahue from the Associated Press has more.
He was in power less than 7 years, but Gorbachev unleashed a breathtaking series of changes. It included the freeing of Eastern European nations from Russian domination and the toppling of the Berlin Wall. Years later, Gorbachev said the end of the Cold War was a moment in history for global cooperation and problem solving, but it didn't happen.
The West, and particularly the United States, declared victory in the Cold War. Euphoria and triumphalism went to the heads of Western leaders.
Gorbachev resigned in 1991. The Soviet Union later collapsed. News organizations quoted a statement saying Gorbachev died after a long illness. I'm Ed Donahue.
Ambassador Herman J. Cohen served as U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs under President George H.W. Bush. He is also the author of a 2020 book entitled U.S. Policy Towards Africa, Eight Decades of Realpolitik. Cohen tells VOA's James Butty that Gorbachev should be remembered as a leader who played a crucial role in bringing peace to three African countries, Angola, Ethiopia, and Mozambique, that were at civil war at the time.
President Gorbachev played a major role in bringing peace to three African countries that had civil war. That was Angola, Mozambique, and Ethiopia. When he met with President George H.W. Bush in 1990, he said, "Why don't we work together in bringing peace to these countries?" And President Bush agreed. So Gorbachev assigned one of his people to work with me. I was the Assistant Secretary of State for Africa. And we worked in these three countries. We had peace negotiations. And by the end of 1992, all three countries' civil wars ended. So I give President Gorbachev a lot of credit for starting the process of bringing peace to these three countries.
And yet, Ambassador, as he passes away, we have war in Ukraine that is imposing tremendous hardship, not only on Africa, but almost globally. What do you make of that distinction?
Well, when he was president of the Soviet Union, even after he left the presidency, he tried to change the political situation in the Soviet Union. He wanted to make it more democratic, but it was impossible. The Communist Party of the Soviet Union was too powerful. And I think that this caused the former President Gorbachev to become very depressed and led to his illness. So his success in Africa was not matched in Russia, I'm afraid.
So can we connect democracy in Africa to the role that Gorbachev might have played?
I think so, because he said, yes, we must stop these civil wars, because the Soviet Union was supplying money to the Mozambican government and the Russian and the Angolan government, the Ethiopian, in order to pursue war against the rebels. And he decided that this was not a good thing. Instead of fighting rebels, they should negotiate. So I think this was the beginning of democracy coming to Africa. First you end the wars, and then you bring democracy.
Coincidentally, Angola just had election. How about that?
A elections are very good in Angola, but I have the feeling that the government of Angola could not allow itself to be defeated. So I think UNITA, who had observers in every election office, has decided that the election was not free and fair. And I tend to believe UNITA.
Ambassador Cohen, in a few words, how do you think Africa should remember the late Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev?
He was the first Soviet leader to look to have peace in Africa. All previous leaders wanted to encourage civil wars and use of military. He was the first leader to encourage peace in Africa.
Ambassador Cohen, thank you so much. A pleasure always to speak with you.
Thank you.
That was Ambassador Herman Cohen, who served as U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs under President George H.W. Bush, speaking with VOA's James Butte. The renewed clashes between the Ethiopian government and the Tigray People's Liberation Front, TPLF, has shattered a five-month-old truce and cast a shadow over efforts to try to end the nearly two-year conflict in Africa's second most populous country. William Davison is a senior analyst for Ethiopia at the Crisis Group. I asked him why peace talks between the two factions never materialized.
We've had a very significant period of reduced fighting this year, really ever since the Tigray forces retreated to Tigray in December, and then that was consolidated by the truce a few months later. And then we've seen some increase in food aid delivery. But of course, none of the underlying political disagreements that led to the conflict have been addressed, let alone resolved. And also we've had major problems emerge during the conflict, such as the atrocities and Amhara region taking control of Western Tigray. On top of the failure to address those differences, or accompanying that, has of course been the failure to really get this peace process off the ground. Yes, two sides have had covert meetings, but we've had no internationally mediated formal negotiation. Now, on the surface, the reasons for that are the difference over the mediator, Tigray rejecting the African Union envoy Obasanjo as biased, and disagreement over the issue of restoring services and humanitarian access, with Tigray's government insisting that that is all facilitated prior to talks, and also referring repeatedly to the return to Tigray's pre-war borders as an obligation of the federal government. And instead, although the position has, there have been different statements, essentially the federal government has said that it's willing to turn up unconditionally for negotiations and discuss all of these issues there, and that was rejected by Tigray. So we have the context of a very volatile situation with nothing resolved, and so a very fragile truce, then accompanied by this failing peace process, via failure to get off the ground. That led to a renewed spike in tensions, belligerent rhetoric, and troop mobilization. And that was the context for this very worrying resumption of fighting that we've seen over the last week.
It's very hard to verify what's going on in that Tigray area because there's no access to media or anything. As far as you are concerned, has fighting actually begun? And who is attacking who?
Well, there's definitely been very serious clashes in northern Amhara, southern Tigray border areas. It's very hard for me to say authoritatively who fired the first shot, I'm afraid. And then in addition to that, we've also seen the Federal Air Force bomb targets in Mekele, allegations by the Tigray authorities that they hit civilian targets. There's some reports of clashes in western areas, as well as around Waghimra as well. So yes, there's various sort of ongoing active hostilities.
For these two factions to return back to peaceful negotiations, the underlying concerns and differences you were mentioning, what has to be rectified?
There has to be a step-by-step incremental process. There's nothing like a silver bullet to resolving this situation, as you and your listeners know. Obviously, we need to de-escalate, see a recommitment to a cessation of hostilities, and then both the parties need to think about their approach to the idea of getting negotiations underway. Can Tigray's government find a way of turning up for talks, formal internationally mediated talks, and make some of their demands there? What can the federal government do to alleviate the situation inside Tigray by improving humanitarian access, reconnecting Tigray to normal, vital public services and commercial traffic as a confidence-building measure in advance of talks? And critically, the international actors here, the African actors, the African Union, need to swing into a far more concerted, urgent action than they've shown so far, realize the gravity of this renewed outbreak of conflict and the risk of escalation, insist on a recommitment to the truce, and do everything needed to get these talks convened as soon as possible, because that is the only way to move the parties away from the prospect of a return to all-out war. And it's the only way to get them into a position where they can start addressing some of the very difficult underlying political issues. They're at the heart of the disagreements and the conflict.
That was William Davison, senior analyst for Ethiopia at the Crisis Group. He was talking to me from London. After 2 years of ceasefire, stability in Libya is under threat, with deadly clashes erupting in Tripoli between armed militias backing the two rival governments. Libyan experts are calling for a new approach to keep the country from sliding back to violent confrontation. VOA senior analyst Mohammed Al-Shenawi has the details.
The international community focused on holding elections in Libya as the first step to reset the political scene. But the collapse of UN-backed efforts to establish a roadmap for voting, which was delayed in December 2021, worsened severe divisions between rival groups. The clashes in Tripoli grew from the quest for legitimacy between the internationally recognized government of national unity, GNU, under Abdelhamid Dbeibah, and the rival administration appointed by the eastern-based House of Representatives under Fathi Bashagha. Fathi Ali, former vice president of the Libyan Presidential Council, says all armed formations in Libya are funded by the government, so they benefit from the security vacuum and the country's political crisis.
They are preventing the government from developing a professional security apparatus. What Libya needs when it comes to the security sector, we need security sector reform, temporary security arrangement. And unless we establish a vision for a new security sector in Libya, any political sharing agreement will fall.
Ali noted that all UN agreements fail to include that sector in power sharing to break Libya's cycle of violence. To learn from past lessons, he suggested that instead of holding elections, Libya could try to reach a power sharing agreement with a decentralized system, transferring resources and decision-making process to the locals, besides a central government with local participation. Federica Fasanotti is a senior fellow at the Italian Institute of International Political Studies. She blamed the UN for focusing on holding elections while Libya's institutions are very weak.
The vision was wrong because they thought, for example, that elections are the first manifestation of democracy. But it's not true. Institutions are the foundation for democracy because they represent the link between the politics and the population.
She said Libyan institutions were too weak to contain violence, which crumbled stability, while the UN mission in Libya treated politicians as democratic leaders, although they fought for power. She noted that a political solution appears increasingly difficult with sustained escalations and protracted political stalemates that will inevitably threaten Libya's ability to implement a stable democratic system. Libya is now at a critical juncture where the next steps will significantly impact the future of the political process, economic construction, development, and the rebuilding of public infrastructure. Tariq Youssef, director of Middle East Council and Global Affairs, said the U.S. and its allies can defuse the crisis, provide a roadmap that hopefully takes Libya to elections, and begin working on rebuilding state institutions and rehabilitating the economic management, especially the oil sector. Mohammed Al-Shenawi, VOA News, Washington.
Kenya's Supreme Court has started hearing arguments and challenges to the presidential election. opposition candidate Raila Odinga is among those challenging the results and alleging a range of problems with the election process. The chairman of the Election Commission declared Deputy President William Ruto the winner earlier this month with just over 50% of the votes. However, four of the seven commission members say they do not agree with that declaration. Earlier this week, Reuters News quotes Odinga as saying he is convinced he won the election, but if the Supreme Court rules otherwise, he will accept the decision. Ruto's legal response has been to reject allegations of improprieties in the election and the vote counting. The chairman of the Election Commission has said that the election was free, fair, and credible in his court response. The court must rule on all charges by the end of Monday. Former Botswana President Ian Khama didn't show up for a scheduled court appearance today on charges of illegal possession of firearms. Khama fled to South Africa in November but hinted this week he is close to returning home. From Habrone, Botswana, reporter Mokondisi Dube has the details.
In April, Khama was formally charged with 14 counts of theft and illegal possession of firearms. Also charged were three other high-profile figures, including suspended police commissioner Kiabetsu Makope and former intelligence services boss Isaac Khosi. Khama was due to appear in a Habron court this week, but remains in South Africa. His court defendants made a brief appearance, and the case was postponed to November 3. In June, state prosecutors said they were ready to apply for Khama extradition. However, the former head of state is yet to be served with court papers. Previously, Khama told VOA he would welcome extradition.
If it is the regime's intention to apply for extradition for me, I would very much welcome that. Because extradition doesn't happen in a manner whereby they put in the application one day, and the next day you're back in the country. There's a legal process that has to be followed, which would include an appearance in a South African court.
He said appearing in court will allow him to clear his name.
It would give me a wonderful opportunity with my legal team from Botswana, with the growing number of key witnesses in that country, and with the legal team I would put together here in South Africa, to expose the lies and fabrications that Masisi and his cronies have been embarking upon against me. So for me, it would be a wonderful opportunity, as I said, because what comes out in that court would also go public widely.
This week, Khama told South African media he was close to returning home sooner than later, although he maintains his life is in danger. The South African government says Khama is not a fugitive, but a guest. For VOA, this is Mkondisi Dube in Habroni, Botswana.
At the Climate Week conference in Libreville, African leaders are being urged to forge a unified approach to climate change that Gabon President Ali Bongo Ondimba called an existential threat to the continent's cities. Egyptian Foreign Minister Sameh Shoukry told the 1,000 government officials and stakeholders that the international community is backtracking on efforts to finance African mitigation and adaptation methods. Egypt's Al Ahram paper reports he urged civil society, youth farmers, and the private sector to call for equitable solutions. Shoukry will host the UN Climate Change Conference in Egypt in November. The Africa Climate Week meeting opened on Monday and continues through Friday. Governments and stakeholders have a chance to craft transformative responses to climate change, social inequalities, and environmentally safe investments in a proposed low-emission economy. East Africa and the Horn are suffering from drought. The Sahel is being pounded by sandstorms, and Central, Western, and Southern Africa are dealing with floods. A World Health Organization, UNICEF, global study of healthcare facilities finds half lack basic hygiene services, putting around 3.85 billion people at risk of infection and death. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
The study is based on data from 40 countries representing 35% of the world's population. It presents an alarming picture of health facilities that lack water and soap for hand washing, have dirty toilets, and are unable to manage health care waste. It says the lack of safe water, sanitation, and basic hygiene services, known as WASH, in healthcare facilities can lead to many preventable deaths. Rick Johnston is WHO lead, WHO UNICEF joint monitoring program for WASH. He says sepsis, a major cause of mortality globally, could be prevented by improving WASH services in healthcare.
It causes about 11 million avoidable deaths each year. And we know that in healthcare settings, sepsis mortality is linked to poor quality of care, including inadequate WASH. Still, today, 670,000 neonatal deaths occur due to sepsis. So there's a huge burden that could be improved right there.
Data show the situation tends to be better in hospitals than in smaller healthcare facilities. The WHO reports the 46 least developed countries lag most behind in hygiene services, with only 32% of healthcare facilities providing WASH services. Johnston says sub-Saharan Africa is the geographic region with the lowest coverage of basic services, about a third lower than globally.
I mentioned hand hygiene services at 51% globally. It's only 38% in sub-Saharan Africa. Water services, 78% globally, only 52% in sub-Saharan Africa. But in sub-Saharan Africa, only 13% of healthcare facilities met the requirement for a basic healthcare service. So, yeah, lots of work to be done in sub-Saharan Africa.
The WHO estimates the cost of achieving universal basic WASH services in the 46 least developed countries at less than $10 billion between now and 2030. While that sounds like a lot, WHO officials say it comes to just under $1 per person per year. Officials say that is a fraction of what currently is being spent on healthcare services in those countries. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari says half a million people have been affected by floods caused by heavy rains since the start of the year. An Associated Press report indicates 23 of the 36 states in Africa's most populous country are affected by seasonal flooding, with the Northeast particularly hard hit this year. Buhari's office said emergency services were providing aid and he was receiving regular updates on the floods, which have affected more than 500,000 Nigerians since January. In his statement, Buhari said the destructive floods have displaced 73,379 people, caused more than 100 casualties, and injured about another 270 people. In Maiduguri, the regional capital of northeast Borno State, the epicenter of the country's more than a decade-long jihadist insurgency, people displaced by the conflict have seen their farms and homes destroyed by floods. Flooding is common in many parts of Nigeria during the rainy season, which runs from May to September. And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yeheyes Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, and our engineer, Nashwan Kali, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.